You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic.
I'm Nikita Smilvich, PhD candidate at Northwestern University, studying Russian literature and film.
And I'm Cameron Lalana, a literature enthusiast and guy working in media. We're two friends who met studying in Russia. We like talking about books so much that we made it into a podcast.
And that podcast, this podcast, is the podcast for people wanting to learn more about Slavic literature, art, and culture. Every episode, we'll be bringing you the background and analysis you'll need to know to understand these works.
If you're interested in supporting us, you can head on over to our website, slaviclitpod.com. All right, Matt, what are we getting into this week?
This week, we are going to be diving on into the short story, Light Breathing, sometimes translated Gentle Breathing, by Van Boonen. I don't think we've covered him at all on the show before, so I'm looking forward to it.
No, we have not. And if anyone listening to this has taken even a single Slavic or Russian literature class in college, you were almost certainly assigned this at some point. This was the very first work I ever had to read for any Slavic literature class I took or Slavic culture class I took in college. So coming full circle back, and it's only taken 8 years, 7 years. Let's not quantify it too much.
Yeah, I'm kind of would like some insight as to why this seems to be a universally assigned text when Boonen has like other short stories or even like novellas that are kind of comparable that could be assigned to an undergraduate that would probably take about the same amount of time to read that are like more, I don't want to say well-respected, but are more of what he would be probably known for.
Right.
So I don't know. I guess I should know. And my answer would be that this one, you don't really actually have to know that much going into it. And so that makes it kind of approachable in that sense. But I do find it interesting that everybody that I know has read this. Well, everybody that I know that has taken a Russian literature class, not that I have a sort of, that I can't be friends with anybody who hasn't read Boonen's Light Breathing.
That's a pretty important qualifier. Although, if the other one was true, that'd be pretty impressive as well.
Right, right.
Yeah, so I guess that kind of gets at a little bit about why we're talking about this, but is there any, like, before we really start talking about it, is there anything else that would really, for you, is why we're covering either Light Breathing or Boonen in general?
Yeah, well, there is a pretty big one, actually. If you're not aware, Boonen was somebody who won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1933. Not a common thing for Russians, Soviets. Quite a political history of who wins the Nobel Prize in Literature. And that's a kind of an interesting story for another day, perhaps. Or you can just go online and Google it because people have written about this. And it is really fascinating how lots of other writers who are, and I don't mean to say this to denigrate Boonen because he is a great writer in his own way, in his own right, and he's certainly a better writer than me. There are better writers that have not won Nobel Prize, and there are better writers from Russia who did not win Nobel Prizes. So interesting that he wins kind of as he's in emigration in the 30s. So we'll talk a little bit more about that, but that was another aspect that kind of interested me in starting to talk about him a little bit, because I don't think we've talked about emigre literature. I mean, like, it in some ways, but not from this period, I don't think. We've done more like modern emigre literature, which is a different sort of thing. So,
yeah, for sure. But relevant right now, especially as we cover Grossman as covering writers who, the difference in treatment for writers who did go leave and writers who did not. But speaking of emigration, Boonen's case, why don't we take a step back and look at the whole of Boonen's life to get a better sense of who we're talking about here for those who might not be familiar.
Well, I don't like that you set me up to do the whole of his life, I'll tell you that much. Because I didn't make notes on the whole of his life because I wasn't going to tell you all of it. I was going to give you the brief of his life.
I'm sorry to say, but this is an extended series. I don't know if you're aware. We got to go. I was kind of prepping for at least a good 8 episodes out of this.
Stop. That's a legitimate stress dream of mine.
All right, let's take a brief history of Boonen's life.
So I really wanted to focus in on a specific part of his life, and that is the sort of immediate post-revolution and what that kind of looks like for Bunin. So he's a little bit older at this point. When the revolution comes around, he's should be 46, 47. He's born in 1870 and he lives to 1953. So he's not a new writer by any means. He's influenced heavily by the big novel Russian realists like Tolstoy. This is a huge influence on him. I think he's actually arrested for distributing Tolstoyan literature, and the charges, I believe, cleared. And so this is where he is probably most commonly... It's what he's kind of commonly known for, one of the things. As I was looking around doing some prep work for this particular episode, I see a lot of claims that say Bunin is the heir to the Russian realist tradition, stemming from Tolstoy, and he has a great respect for Tolstoy in particular. I don't know that I agree that he's necessarily an heir to the realist, but that's a separate question we can set aside. Because what I find most interesting about him is this probably little known event that happens shortly after the revolution. I did not know about this until graduate school. Maybe I just missed it, but there was a short time after the revolution where, in order to kind of get the country's intellectuals in line with the sort of philosophical program, Lenin essentially exported a bunch of intellectuals abroad. A lot of them ended up in Paris. And so these were called the philosopher's ships, or the philosopher's steamers, which is kind of not an apt term for it, because there weren't actually that many philosophers on board. There were obviously philosophers, there were people involved in literature, arts, religion, lots of different areas. A lot of very smart and well-known people were, they weren't forced to leave. They were heavily encouraged to leave. It basically said the government said basically there is no place for you here. We're going to pay for you to get on this ship and leave and never come back. Take some of your things, but nothing that's too valuable, and leave the country. And so this is what happens to Bunin, and he ends up in Paris for a while, and he's part of this sort of Parisian emigre community, which is a very sort of white army sympathetic group, or, you know, tends to be. You would kind of understand that this wouldn't be the center for Bolshevism in Europe, the people who were kicked out of Russia, tends to be the case. So, right. So Lenin sends them out as a result largely of Trotsky's kind of cultural politics that are emerging in this era, and it's becoming a lot harder for, I would say, the pre-revolutionary intellectuals to keep working. Compared to the 30s, it's still a pretty intellectually free time by comparison, but it's different. And so this time being kind of it's sort of in between time of transition in the 20s, some of these people that left do come back in the 30s. They don't fare too well, all things considered. A lot of people don't fare well in the 30s, so this group would definitely be among them. Many of them were arrested or executed when they returned. Others were able to work fine within the new system, but in general, it wasn't a great sort of, you know, wasn't a great time to be returning to the Soviet Union. This sort of exile, though, it starts a division in Russian literature of specifically what we call emigre literature. And, you know, literature in exile or literature in emigration, and it's sometimes referred to as white emigration, referring to the white army sympathies, or maybe people who were fighting actually in the white army and weren't executed but were, you know, chose to leave for obvious reasons. And so you get a sort of split at this time of people who see themselves, I think, as the heir, right, to the Russian realist. I think that Bunin would love to have been described as that. And he is sort of that representative on the literature in emigration side, or literature in exile side. And then in terms of Soviet literature, you get Maxim Gorky, who becomes that variant, but on the Soviet side. So this is kind of a period of emigration that is not really talked about that much, at least not in sort of maybe as much public discourse. I think the wave of immigration that really starts to attract more attention is a little bit later, when you get the sort of Solzhenitsyns. That tends to be a little bit more, we'll say it tends to be better for like U.S. Western propaganda purposes, and it sort of rides that wave to public popularity. But I think it's just important for us to kind of note that that's the political situation of where a lot of Bunin's writing is coming from. And the story that we're reading today, it takes place before he goes in, or he writes it. It's published before he goes into exile, actually published a year before the revolution. So we still get some of, I'd say, tumultuous. It's not exactly a great picture, great depiction of pre-revolutionary life. But that's where we stand. Not exactly a whole history of Bunin, but the part of it that I like, that I find interesting.
Probably the part that's most relevant to this, to discussing today's work.
Perhaps. Just perhaps.
Just maybe. Well, for the purposes of this podcast, it is.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so yeah, as Matt mentioned, this is published in 1916, April. This is in the Easter edition of the newspaper, which I don't have the name here, but not that important. And we have an interesting story. It starts on a graveyard, and we come to the grave of a young woman, a young girl, Olya or Olga Mishierskaya. From there, we go on to learn more about her background. So this, as if you've read this, it's a fairly short piece, and if you haven't, you should. It's, I think, available online, and certainly, like you've said, if you've ever bought a reader, either an Ivan Bunin reader or, frankly, any reader that just covers Soviet, or no, that covers Russian or Slavic literature, I'd say pretty good odds it's going to be in there.
Mine, it was not in my Bunin reader that I had, believe it or not.
Really?
Yes.
Well, I mean, given its place, how you've opined on its place in Bunin's canon, maybe there are others who agree.
Well, there's just others that are like considered more important, I would say, or more major, maybe more well known.
Mm.
I don't know. I still like the short story, and yeah, I have one of the Penguin Bunin readers, and I could swear it was in there. And I was trying to locate my copy that I had all of my notes on, and I somehow lost it somewhere. It's somewhere in my bookshelves.
It's deep in the stack in the 100 books you have in your closet.
100 is an understatement.
All right, the innumerable numbers of books that weigh down your closet that one day will tear down your house.
Yeah, the tomes.
Your tomes. That's right.
My tomes. Don't touch my tomes.
You got to respect the tomes. In this house, we stand for the flag and sit down for the tomes because they have so much weight on your shoulders.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Anywho, yeah, so this is about Olya Mishierskaya, and it's hard to tell the story. I'll do a brief chronological version of this.
Oh, yeah, do the chronological so I can make a good point. Yeah,
okay, perfect.
Come on, coach, I'm ready.
All right, we'll get you out in the field in just a moment, but short version is the locus sort of the story is Mishierskaya and the experiences that lead up to her death at the age of 15. So the thing to know about Olya is that she is at the age of 14 or 15 noted for being particularly beautiful in various ways that the story goes into in greater detail. This is something that captures the envy of many other people, the obsessions of many other people. And it is something that is rather suddenly forced upon her at an early age, starting in around 14 into 15. One of her father's friends, who is an officer, I think in the cavalry, or an officer of some sort, who forces himself onto Olya between the ages of 14 and 15, some point in the summer, at which point people begin to notice a change in her attitude, whereas before she kind of engaged in the merriment of life, and now it's as if she is sort of, as they would say, lost herself to this gaiety, this merriment of life, which causes one day the headmistress of her school to bring her in to chastise her over how she's been behaving, at which point she says, you know, you're wearing your hair like a woman, you are not. And then Olya says, well, I am, I became a woman last summer, and tells her what happened And I think about a month after that, Olya is shot dead at the train station by the same officer as the investigators later find as a result of her telling him that she did not love him and did not want to marry him, and so he shoots her dead. And the story ends on a former teacher of hers sitting on a bench. As it said, she comes to regularly to visit this grave and thinks back on a conversation that Olya had with a friend of hers, in which she kind of talks about finding a sort of a book telling telling women how to act to be, you know, proper, quote unquote, which entails all these ways of dressing and wearing your makeup, but especially breathing lightly. And then the story kind of ends on, and now that breath is out among, you know, all of us all around here. That's the version which is in order, which is very much not how it happens when you are reading it. And I'll go ahead, and now that I've hit the ball up, throw it over to you.
Are you batting and fielding?
I have to say I was kicked off the T-ball team, so this, I don't know if this explains some things about that decision.
Cameron playing for the T-ball and exile team. All right, I got to make my point, but before I do, I wanted to take just a quick break. We'll be back in just a second.
Absolutely. And this episode is brought to you by you, our listeners. You can support independent podcasting by heading to our website, SlavicLitPod.com. You'll get access to the notes we use to make this episode, including links to all secondary sources mentioned. There's no further sentence. Including
no,
links.
I didn't think so, but I did. The tone. If you want to support the show but don't want to spend any of your quickly depreciating rubles, you can join our email list for free at SlavicLitPod.com or leave us a nice review wherever you get your podcasts.
Questions, comments, want to appear on our Office Hours podcast? Drop us a line. You can reach our voicemail at 209-800-3944, or you can also email us a voice recording or text question at slaviclitpod@gmail.com. We'll bring your question onto the podcast and do our best to address it.
All right, let's get back to the breath work.
I didn't like that. Okay, so that's the chronological order, but it's not in chronological order. It is very out of order.
Yes, it is very much so. This is kind of the main, like, trick of the story, I would say, because when you break down what the story actually is, there is not that much actually happening in terms of the raw action of the story. But this is a story that I think has a very emotionally striking impact when you read it for the first time. And that is kind of one of the questions that people have been looking at for, it's still looking at it. There's still things being written about it. Not as much as I had anticipated there being written about it, but nevertheless, there is still some stuff. And this was also a question sort of not specifically as a result of light breathing, but as a result of a more serious inquiry going into literary studies in the 1920s and beyond with the Russian formalists, who were a hugely influential school of literary criticism and literary theory in Russia and the Soviet Union. And they're still, I feel like probably everybody that does a humanities PhD touches on some of their thinking at some point or another. And I'm not going to bore you with too much about what they were looking into, but the main gist of their school is that they're trying to look into what sort of differentiates literature from other arts. And they're trying to figure out what is it that makes something literary? What are the devices used? How is it constructed? You know, what can we break down into a clear, you know, kind of clear object of study, more or less? And so you can probably see from there how they would be interested in the way a story is actually organized and arranged. And so this actually, I think, comes out of, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of the research comes out of the study of fairy tale. So Vladimir Propp, who kind of collected and organized and categorized so many folk and fairy tales, this is one of the important aspects of the formalist school, and one of the ways that this kind of thinking on narrative starts to develop by Viktor Shklovsky, amongst many others who are involved in the school. And so, long story short, they come up with these two different terms that they use to describe essentially what is happening in the narrative and then the actual structure of the narrative. And these are two things that are huge for light breathing. They're also huge in fairy tales and folk tales, which often present something that is very simple, like, you know, like this sort of simple Tolstoyan truth appearing to you out of some animal's mouth or something. And that is the same kind of impact that I get from reading this story at the end. There is some, it's not quite there, but it almost feels like some profound truth is about to be revealed to you as you connect all of the pieces of the story as they're kind of disparately arranged around the, you know, narrative. And it's just very interesting. It's very striking. It yields a very large emotional effect on the reader, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the upsides, I guess, of this particular technique, whereas if you told the story in order, as I did, you kind of, the main climax of the story is Olya's death. It's the moment in which she's killed, and the very fact of her death kind of hangs over. However, in this version, from the moment you begin, you know that she's dead from the moment she's introduced. And when she's shot midway through, I think it's interesting. It's it is mentioned. It's one sentence, a very brief, just, oh, she was shot on, you know, by an officer in a train car in the middle of a larger paragraph. And it was a month after this conversation that a Cossack officer, ugly and commonplace in appearance, who had absolutely no connection with the level of society to which Olya Mishurskaya belonged, shot her dead on the platform of a railroad station in the midst of a large crowd of people who had just arrived on the train. And then it goes on to talk about what she had told her headmistress a while back. And so in this telling, the actual moment of death, which I think in other stories would be a bigger moment, would be something that's much more focused on, or we're drawn to as readers in a story that's just told in order, because what is there to say after she dies, really, right? In this version, which is out of order, it's one more moment among many in a story which we already know she's dead. Okay, so that's how she gets there. And it creates this strange effect where even in the final moments of this short story, what we're hearing are her own words. And so this entire time she exists in this sort of paradoxical state of being dead the whole time through, and yet always being alive in a sort. Her presence is felt after she's told to us, after it's told that we're standing at her grave, we are introduced to what it was like for her to grow up. And again, when we finish the story at her grave, we hear more from her own words speaking to a friend. So in telling the story as it is, it removes this sort of, I think, traditional draw to the fact of death, to this sort of shocking end, and allows us to think more on what Bunyan is conveying to us about this character who is alive with this knowledge of death too, right? That colors each thing we learn about it rather than just being focused on the fact of death itself.
Yes, very well put. And I just wanted to clarify that when you say her own words, we get this sort of, we get diary entries, basically.
Yes. Well, I mean the memory that the teacher has at the very end of her speaking to her friend, but yes, also her, yes. Yeah, that diary entry as well.
That one at the end is interesting, because the diary entry, I feel like, yeah, sure, she wrote that, but then because there are so many layers to the story, it's not really, you know, it's not really questionable. It sure seems like there was something she said that would be a long quote to, you know, my point is just how good is your memory, basically? Is this really attributable to her? I don't know. I don't know that the narrator is necessarily unreliable by any means, but it's sort of it's something in my mind.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that is a good question to bring up. I just think about it when I'm reading those words, this final thing it leads us on. This is a big question I had for myself going into this story, as I always have going into any work we do. Why is it named what it is? And sometimes you can't put too much into it. You know, it might be something a publisher chose, as with what was it when we did The Orchard with Christina Gorchva Newberry, and her editor had chosen The Orchard for, and she really wanted Dog and Wolf, or the time of Dog and Wolf.
Well, it is in the UK if you want that edition.
That's right. So if you get one from the UK, you can get a much cooler title than the one that
they're both cool.
That's right. Either way, you have the book, and that's cool in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. You have a tome, which we respect in this house.
That's right. We in this house we respect tomes. So we end this piece in these words that were given from the words that were given by this teacher are, and this is Olya describing to a friend what how a young woman should act. The main thing, do you know what it is? Light breathing. And I've got it. Listen how I breathe. Isn't that it? And then from the quote, it goes down to a more general. And now this light has been breathed. And now this light breathing has been wafted anew through the world in this cloudy sky, in this cold spring wind. So in the same way that her presence is felt throughout this book, that sort of some sort of characteristic of self is thrown back out into the world. You know, that characteristic of self also is ever present through the story by her simultaneous life and deathlessness, or deathless life, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I think it's a major aspect of the story. I think that a little maybe biographical tidbit that is interesting to know was specifically that Bunin wrote this short story for the Easter edition of the magazine in which he was publishing. And when you do that in a country that cares about religion, which this is still 1916, so there, you know, this is still before the everything, of trying to get rid of religion, this is a major important fact. And the whole sort of, I feel like I don't need to explain Easter, but celebrating the resurrection of Christ is sort of thematically what this story is about. Maybe not Christ per se, but just the way in which resurrection can kind of work metaphorically and maybe literally as well in the story, depending on kind of how you read it. But the fact that it starts with Olya's death sort of enables the story to even happen in the first place. So you have a literary resurrection. She is like Christ trampling down death by death. And you have these religious themes kind of circulating throughout the story. And this is kind of this is really important, I think. I think if you don't take into account the issue that this was written, the issue of the magazine that it was written for, that might be something that you maybe you miss. Maybe not. Maybe that's ever present on your mind. and you don't. But that was kind of one of the things that I had come across while researching that I thought was interesting.
Yeah, for sure. And so from there, if you don't mind, if we want to move on, something I wanted to talk about, and this is something you got in your notes, and it was something I was thinking about too. One step beyond, all right.
Sure it was.
Sure. First step here is, okay, we've got, because of the way this sort of the structure of the story, we get the benefit of Olya's presence throughout this novel without it being overtaken by her death. So then what does her presence say? And one of the things that struck me is this, initially I went in kind of looking at this as a tale approaching the issues around growing up, especially around being an adolescent. But as you very quickly get into the story, it very quickly becomes clear that this is not a typical childhood, right? I mean, you know, of course, the major feature there is Melyutin, who's the friend of her father, who rapes her as a 14-year-old, as a 15-year-old. We also have the fact that he then will
should
later
be noted that he's 56. I don't know if we mentioned that specifically.
I don't think we have said that. Yes, he's in his mid-50s.
Just wanted to throw that out there.
There we go. Got that in addition.
Not that it morally changes anything, but, you know. That's right. There.
Yes. So you've got that. And then, of course, obviously, he will later shoot and kill her as well. So then the question for me becomes, all right, so these things that set her experiences apart, or what is there to look at there? And I think one of the major things for me is the beauty that she has. And I think you phrase it well in your notes here that, if you don't mind, I'm just going to read your note off.
Yeah, no, by all means. No, yeah, just take them. To be fair, I took them from my own, from a seminar I took. That I was
self-plagiarism.
I slapped those notes right on in there. I forgot I did a presentation on this.
That's awesome. So you're prepared.
Well, I don't know if I'd say it was one of my best ones, but I did one.
But you practiced at least. Well, you practiced for the real event, which is this podcast.
Right. I'm now rehearsed and I'm polished. Which, if you're listening, you might think, "Oh, what does he sound like normally?"
But take this line from your notes. You've got the force that propels the story, and Olya herself has to do with her beauty, something beyond her control, which I think is a great point then, because then when we we have Olya ever present, but interestingly, we never really, we very rarely get to see Olya from her own perspective. And I think that's, you made a great point earlier that even the recollection of the quote, of the recollection of her conversation is itself a recollection from a flawed person externally. So there is only the diary entry that we have that really gives us her in her own words. Otherwise, she's characterized and everyone around her only understands her through these characteristics over which she has no control. Her hair, the way she wears that, the way she is just casually very natural, right? I mean, the way it's described is, I think every young person would like to be like that, in which even your flaws seem natural and carefree. And, well, you know, you, whatever, you fall down, show off your knee by accident, it's like, well, that's just, this is how it goes. It's not an embarrassing, you know, not an embarrassing slip, all this kind of stuff. And so despite all this great amount of knowledge we have about her, we, except for the diary entry, have very little insight into her herself, right? The claim, the reason why the officer shoots her, he says that Olya had led him on. She promised him that she loved him, that she was going to marry him. And then when you get to the station, he says, she cruelly laughed at me and said, no, she had never loved me and would not marry me. And, you know, of course, I shot her dead. A very normal and natural reaction to have when you were a 56-year-old man who has raped a 14-year-old. We have insight into that, a small amount, through her diary entry in which she describes this event. Most of it is pretty much just a recollection of what happened. But there is one moment where she's describing what happens, and then you just kind of go into this ellipsis, and then she writes, I don't know how it could have happened. I must have gone out of my mind. Never did I think I was that kind. There's only one way out for me now. Which sort of has a overtone of suicidal ideation there, which I think is an interesting addition here. But so this is a recollection of the event from her own words, and we have this interesting locus of control, which maintains internally, perhaps, and I don't say this too often, more so than it should. She is acting like she had, or she, when she's thinking about this situation, thinks about it in terms of her own actions. When what has happened is this, older man has seen her as, seen her and is attracted to these things that she personally has no control over. And then forces himself upon her. And then we still have this sort of adaptation that I guess every young person has to come to eventually, which is that she tries to like fit this thing, this body she's growing into, right? I mean, in the very last moment we have her discussing with her friend all these things she has to do. You might like have to, your eyes have to be dark, like boiled tar, which she kind of makes fun of. She doesn't quite understand. You have to have long lashes. And she doesn't fully understand these things that she's told she has to do in order to fully keep on being, you know, a woman, this vague idea, this nebulous idea, which she sort of both grows into naturally by virtue of the traits she has, but also she must reinforce through these other, you know, actions and the way she dresses and the way she looks and the way she breathes. And so you have this interesting contradiction, this look into a mind which is still trying to assert itself and still asserting itself over a lot of features and controls and moments and over which this person does not actually have that much action, control, I mean to say.
You're so dancing around this, I wanted to know if you were going to step in it or not, because I think it is a legitimate reading that you can have of this, and it fits into this reading, though not completely on our Easter themes, but in this world where our, I don't know if you can call her protagonist, I guess we can for now, where our protagonist has so little control, where it feels, much of the story just feels so predatory, and the world around her feels so predatory, and you know, even her own sort of remembrance is controlled by other people, you know, does she try to get herself killed? Does she reassert her will? Does she reassert a sense of independence by doing this, by trying to antagonize the cavalry officer?
I think that's a very fair question, especially in light of, you know, how that diary entry ends. There's only one way out for me now. I think that's a great question to ask, too, of this young person, this young mind, who has so little control in so many ways. But still, when we see the few moments she has does keep asserting her own will, rightly or wrongly, or asserting the sense of control over the situation. So I think, yeah, that is a very fair question to ask. I think the text does push you towards possibly that understanding of it.
There are only so many ways that a sort of imperial Russian woman can assert authority and a sense of will, right? It looks different. It's not, you know, sexual conquest. It's not, you know, imperial conquest, right, in the same way that it is for the men in the narrative. And so that is a question. And then it, of course, begs the question, well, if this is the only way out, really, what sort of society have we created? And that's obviously a clear question based on the end. I mean, you don't have to know. You don't have to do anything religious with the analysis to be pushed to that question, of course.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I don't know. This is one analysis that I've been kind of thinking through, and I'm sure other people that have read it have thought of it. Or maybe I'm crazy. I don't know. I think one of the things that it does do is it highlights this question that I brought up earlier on Bunin being the sort of Russian realist, the heir to the Russian realist. And, you know, based on this story, I don't know how you would be able to, I don't know where you get that from exactly. I'd be real curious because when I think of the Russian realist, I think of, for one of them, I think of form. I usually think of novels. It tends to be a great sort of innovation in some ways of realism, the sort of psychological novel. I think of some sort of internal logic that's shaping the narrative. I think of some sort of, I would say, some sort of ethical search, but in most cases, usually didactic. In that case, I think of Tolstoy 100% as the great example of this. And when I start to think of how I would characterize modernism, and specifically the Russian modernists, I tend to think of more fragmentary narratives, the sketches, the short stories. Of course, the realist also had short stories, but they're different. There's a sort of breakdown of unity in Russian modernism. It's a resistance to the psychology of the long novel, and I just think that there is maybe a lot of times there is no like ethical moral, you know, lesson or even big question being posed at all, at least not on the immediate surface level. But I do feel that in this story in a lot of ways where, you know, there's not this clear analysis. You don't know even who the narrator is. You have the school teacher in some cases, you have Olya's perspective. Sometimes you have, some external narrator that's narrating certain scenes that is not the school teacher. So, you know, and then you have the school teacher remembering Olya. And so you just have a lot of different people kind of jostling around for control of the narrative. And that's just very interesting to me. And so just based on this story and from this sort of, these sort of narrative techniques, I don't see necessarily Bunin as, you know, I don't see him completely as the emigre Gorky. It's still something different to me. But, you know, I'm not an expert in, like, genre theory, so.
You're the expert in this conversation, so I hope you'll accept the title nonetheless.
All right, expert in this conversation and nothing else, just one conversation.
I'm going to get that for you on a hat.
Yeah, it's a big, really long hat, yeah.
Just so we need to have that, just throw that disclaimer and just point at the hat and say, well, just keep that in mind, so.
Yeah. Well, I never want anyone to think I have, like, the authoritative reading.
Right.
I think probably people listening to this podcast probably don't think that, because I'm sure if you've read this already, you probably already have something that you're like, why aren't you talking about this? You know, like, I don't know. Why aren't I? It's a good question.
Why aren't you addressing the Shenshin situation? What's up with that? What are you trying to hide?
What are you trying to hide? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, is there anything, I think that for me, honestly, that was talking about the form and the presentation of her character was the main things I wanted to get at. I don't know if there's anything big that you also wanted to address.
I feel like there may have been a few other things to talk about, but I'm, you know, they evade me at the moment. A lot of the other notes that I have taken and that I have in here are kind of the, I have some, no, I have a couple other sources in here that maybe you want to go through and take a look at. They will be available for our paid supporters on our website. So enjoy those if you like.
If you please. If it would please you.
If you don't please, then that's fine. That's fine too.
Well, in that case, I think then thank you for being here today. Thank you for if you have
you're welcome.
Thank you for being here today, Matt.
You don't say it enough, but honestly,
I'll start at the beginning of every recording now. I'll make sure we give a little clap and thank you for being here. But thank you all listeners for being here. As if you've been through a literary education, here's a little more on a story you were probably forced to read. And if you're not, hey, there's your fun fact of the day. Everyone in this discipline has had to read this short story for some reason, which is Matt will be getting to the bottom too. I'll make that promise for him.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. I don't have enough going on, so that's helpful.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I thought you kind of seemed like you had some free time, so I wanted to make sure that you weren't going to get bored.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, before we completely wrap up and banter for another 15 minutes, I got to ask you, Matt, what are we tackling next time?
Next episode, we are going to be doing Life and Fate, the end of book one and into the beginning of book two. That's book one, chapter 30 to book two, chapter 20. And that's going to be coming out on March 29th, 2024. So not next week, but, you know, like we said, trying to stack them towards the end of the month so that we align better with our chapter a day series. And if you're planning on reading along with us, be sure to pick up your copy through our affiliate links on our website. And if you heard me talking about the chapter a day and you're like, wow, I wish I joined 3 months ago, you can still join. You can catch up. We're not really that far into it. You put on your speed reading pants and you'll be there in no time.
Yeah, it's just a quick, 330-something pages to
easy
read?
Breezy. Fortunately, the subject matter is very light, so pick it up. You'll enjoy.
Exactly.
To help keep our show independent and for exclusive access to notes containing all the research that went into this episode, head on over to our website, SlavicLitPod.com. Before we let you go, we want to extend a sincere thank you to all of our current supporters.
Yes, and that's Emma, Lauren, Erica, Michelle, Juliana, Diane, Oleg, John, Timex, Melissa, Baron, Aldo, Ben, Gabe, George, Claire, Amy, Allie. I'm sorry, I got the cat sitting here in my lap. Soraya, Jackson, Molly, Emma, Mike, Marianne, Mickey, Eric, Reagan, Mike, Peter, Eric, Ben, Claire, Jeff, Inez, Mai, Robert, Joseph, Daniel, Lou, Nina, Gary, Janice, Mary, Anne, Isaac, Emily, Amanda, Caitlin, Yitza, Arini, and Pack Rob. The music used in this episode was Staraya Kino by Paramotka. You can find more of their stuff on Bandcamp or Spotify. The links and spelling are in the show notes.
You'll hear from us again soon.